You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 162 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Whew, and it is a hot one.
It is a hot one.
Oh my God.
Hot enough for you?
Oh.
It might be a little too hot.
You called me earlier and said that you had an important question for me, and I was almost certain that it was going to be hot enough for you.
And it was.
It was.
That was in fact the question.
It was.
Well,
What offensive lineman can you come up with for number 62?
Oh, Chris Gray. We did. Okay. We talked about it last week.
Okay. We already prepped
I didn't even have to double check that because I just know that one's true. And if it's not true, then it's a Bernstein Bear effect where it actually is true and someone has just changed every single reference to it online.
Okay.
Since it's so hot, we should cool off.
They call it the Mandela effect.
Sure. Since it's so hot, we should cool off with a blood orange IPA.
There we go.
From our friends at 10 Barrel Brewing Company. An ale with orange flavor. Blood runs cold is the slogan on here, which that does not actually sound appealing for a beer. That sounds terrible and horrifying. But the description, this juicy citrus-infused IPA was brewed with a huge dry hop addition of Simcoe, Mosaic, and Equinox hops to provide an enticing hop aroma. Subtle sweetness from blood orange juice and zest balance the aggressive hop flavor and create a perfect complement to spring fly hatches and long days on the river. None of those things are we going to be doing during this podcast.
That'd be exceedingly strange things to do on a podcast. So you're telling me, though, unrelated to this, because I do need my blood to run cold right now, there is a Pelton hop?
That is correct.
How long has this been in existence?
I feel like it's got to be relatively new, because I hadn't read anything about it until the last couple of years, when all of a sudden a handful of beers named Pelton are popping up. So it comes from a place called Mecca Grade Estate Malt, which is in Oregon, I'm pretty sure, here. Mm. And they have the Pelton
it's funny
Pilsner
that
style hop.
I give like a negative response to Oregon, even though I'm the biggest Blazers fan that there is.
It is very odd.
I'm the one who's going on Blazers Outsiders.
The perfect choice for creating premium lagers, light ales, farmhouse, and wild beer produces a complex, slightly grassy, and crisp wort through which our terroir is pronounced, rustic, yet refined. And they have a picture of a beer, the Ale Apothecary's Sahali, that is made with Pelton hops.
Wow.
I mean,
we
Pelton.
Knew about the Pelton Wheel, famously.
Absolutely.
We knew about Dean Pelton from Community.
Of course.
We knew about the lights at the dentist's office.
What about in Lee Pelton, the president of, formerly Willamette University, but now Emerson University?
Hey, that's a good university.
Yeah.
Well, toast to the Pelton hop, but we have actually, if you're willing to take time out of your day from arguing about Luke Ridenour with Jake One on the internet.
Yes. I think I can find some time.
To do some toasts, first off, I don't know if we have more than one toast.
Yeah, do we have more than one toast?
We're going to toast a lot to it.
Okay.
We're doing a toast first to Jake Ridenour. He's not a Husky quarterback. To Luke Ridenour.
Would that he were a Husky quarterback. I mean, Luke Ridenour forever, man.
Sonic legend Luke Ridenour.
Absolutely.
But then also a toast to our good friend, third Pelton brother, member of the Pelton Cast Legion of Boom, Mina Kimes.
Creator of the Pelton Cast Legion of Boom.
Mm.
Yeah, very excited for her to announce a live episode of the Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny coming to Seattle in the month of July. Already sold out, right?
Is it?
I don't know. I thought so.
I feel like anything like ticket related, you just look to me for. As if...
But it also will feature our other third Pelton brother, Danny Kelly.
Oh, Danny Kelly's going to be there?
He has graduated from a live show with us to a live show with Mina.
I don't know about this. Look, I mean, we invented, much like the Seattle, we invented making food brackets.
Oh, yeah.
And the Seattle Times subsequently stole this idea. We invented Danny Kelly on live podcasts.
It's true. I mean, I feel like this one, it is sold out. He'll probably be better because he won't also have to try to figure out what's going on in the catastrophic Ringer NFL fantasy draft that was going on during the night of our live show.
He'll always remember that night, though.
He really will. I mean, I think we got vaguely referenced in the Ringer's recap of
it. Yeah, vaguely referenced.
Danny talked about what he was doing. That is July 22nd at the Crocodile. But again, if you didn't get tickets, it's too late already.
Well, you at the very least will be in the building.
I will.
I'm a solid maybe.
I didn't ask about a plus one yet.
No, great. I'm not a solid maybe because of that. I'm a solid maybe because I might have other plans.
That you may not be in the city, so yeah.
Well, that's going to be a fun night. I feel like all of Seahawks Twitter is going to be out.
Also, you know, I think back to the excitement that was the Bill Barnwell show coming to Seattle with Mina as a special guest.
You didn't get a plus one from me for that one either.
No, I didn't.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Not only the first time.
Have fun the next time you're at Capitol Block Party and buy tickets.
I'll have fun watching Illuminati hotties. Easy for me to say. Not only was it the first time that I ever met Mina, it was also the first time I met another Third Peldon brother, Zach Whitman.
Wow.
As well as Third Peldon brother, Stephen Cohen. It was a memorable night.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully memories like that are made on July 22nd at the Crocodile with Mina Kimes. It's going to be a huge night. And what might be a busy summer in live Seahawks Twitter podcasts.
Oh, okay. Good to know. We'll keep that cryptic note out there. Any other business to attend to?
Aggregators, get on that.
Yeah. any other toasts to get to here?
No, we got Luke Ridnour out of the way.
Yeah. Check that one off the box. Well, let's get right into our search for Seattle's best sandwich, because we went to a place this week that it is one of my great shames in life I had never been to. As both an Italian-American and as a lover of good food in the city of Seattle, it was shameful that I had never been to Salumi.
Mm-hmm.
You had been like once only, right?
Yes. But I managed after that to shame you often.
That was one more time than me. I mean, now that I had gone to Il Corvo, which we went to this time a year ago.
I went to both of them the same week, my week of eating.
The week of eating, that's right. Salumi was like the one place left on my list.
There should be a lot more places left on your list.
I'm not saying it's the only place I wanted to go, but like it's different than like June Baby or something like that. That's very difficult to get into. I guess we know what you ordered. And B has not been open that long. Salumi has been open for 20 years, which I did not realize until I was doing the research for this podcast.
I didn't realize that they'd moved. I went to the old location.
Oh, well, there you go. Yeah, you gotta realize that. So it was opened by Armandino Batali, the father of now disgraced celebrity chef Mario Batali, in 1999, near where Armandino's grandfather had opened Seattle's first Salumeria, according to the article, over 100 years earlier. It's unclear whether it's 100 years earlier than 2018 when the article was written or 1999, but either way, a long time ago.
What year was the fire?
The Seattle fire?
Yeah.
I want to say 1906, but that may be the Chicago fire.
I thought it was 18 something. I've got to get to Mohai more often.
I've never been.
Oh, it's the best.
I know. I haven't even seen the Sonic stuff that's there.
Really?
Yeah.
You're doing podcasts on Sonic history and can't even look at the Sonic stuff.
That's true.
This is Peltoncast Seattle history.
1889. You are correct.
Nailed it.
Okay, so it was after the fire then. We got that.
No matter what, it was just after the fire.
Yes.
But we're talking Italian roots in the community, somehow even deeper than ours.
Yeah, well, perhaps our great-grandparents went there at some point to the original Salumeria. Who knows?
It probably would have taken them from Georgetown to get to that Salumeria. I don't know if this makes sense travel-wise at the time. I assume they are taking horses.
I think there was the interurban, of course, that connected.
The interurban what?
Like railway.
Were there trains back then?
I think so.
Okay. So they could have
There were definitely trains in the early 1900s, to be clear.
I'm imagining horse and buggy from Georgetown to Pioneer Square. It would have been a whole day experience for them to go.
I feel like they're also at that point, like boat travel through the Duwamish may have been.
Oh, hello.
Thing. Yeah. So that could have been a part of it.
I would have complained about the First Avenue Bridge being up.
yes.
I guess whenever that happens, I'll think about our ancestors. But Italian roots in Seattle.
Yes. Oh, okay. We're just doing some Seattle history now. Early roads were primitive, and before the development of the first intercity rail service in 1899,
wow,
potentially the same time that the Salumeria opened, most shippers and commuters on Puget Sound relied on water transport and mosquito fleet steamers for mobility. By 1912, private interurban lines connected Tacoma, Seattle, and Everett. So there you go.
Well, look at that.
Yeah.
So
anyways, we did not take any of those methods to get to
we drove. But our great grandparents could have gone to Salumeria.
A Salumeria. We don't know what the name is. I don't think that was in that story. Anyways, so Armandino Batali retired from Boeing, where he had worked, and opened up this Salumeria to begin curing meats.
Like, you're really hitting all the Northwest points here.
Yeah.
If his grandchildren Boeing. Work at Amazon.
The ownership has now passed primarily outside the Batali family, with Martinique Grigg and Clara Vineyard, although the Armandino's daughter is still involved, it appears, in the management of the restaurant, and her husband.
Okay.
So, and then as you mentioned, they moved a couple of blocks in Pioneer Square in 2018 to the former home of Rain Shadow Meats Squared as part of expanded operations. And the menus changed slightly in that kind of evolution to offer more pre-designed sandwiches rather than, it was much more of an emphasis on customized sandwiches, I think, when you went previously.
Interesting.
Because you talked about adding mozzarella to something as we were trying to figure out what to get. And I was like, all these sandwiches already come with cheese.
Well, so that you would can still customize. If you do the online ordering, you can still customize pretty easily and pretty heavily.
Much like Taco Time.
Mm-hmm. One of the many ways that salumi is similar to Taco Time is Luke Renauer texting you over here. What is this noise?
I'm getting random emails from ESPN Stats and Information.
About Luke Renauer's career?
They are not about Luke Renauer. They would be very exciting if they were about Luke Renauer's career. I would be into that.
What is he doing now?
I think he's just pretty much retired.
Nice.
Might be coaching a little. I don't know.
Sounds great.
Goes to the UW-Oregon games every year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
not a fan.
He did go to Oregon.
Okay, so you went to Salumi for the first time ever today.
Okay, so one of the reasons I had never been to Salumi is, by all accounts, the lines were like miles long. Mm-hmm. You know the line to get into Jurassic Park to watch games in Toronto? That's how I thought the line at Salumi was.
Oh, is there a crazy line to get in there?
Yes.
Huh.
People are lining up days in advance to go watch the game at Jurassic Park.
To go watch a game in an open area?
Yeah, well, being crammed in there with a ton of other people, it sounds miserable to me. Sometimes in the rain. But shouts to Raptors fans. Well done. Well done, all you guys. Anyway.
Are you joking? Is this a joke?
Well, for that, not for the Kevin Durant thing, obviously.
Okay.
That was not the shouts I was offering.
Wow.
Shouts to everyone outside the
building.
I was
not expecting a shouts to Raptors fans on a podcast this week anywhere.
Their passion.
You might want to delete that for your own sake.
Their passion has been incredible, sometimes misguided. Anyway.
I'm sending this to Kevin Durant.
Sure. He's a little busy.
I'm posting it on the podcast Instagram so that I'll see it.
Yeah. Big fan of the IG. Really loves the Seattle food shots. Anyways, when I went there, I was shocked to discover that there was like basically no line at all. When I went like 11:45 today on a day where it was 90 degrees in Seattle, and you figured a lot of people would want to be waiting in line outside. And there was like, so we were there probably at least 45 minutes, and there was a bit of a rush right around noon where the line backed up a little bit. But even by the time we left at 12:30, virtually no line at all.
Hmm.
So if you're scared off by the line at Salumi, do not be, is my lesson here.
Maybe there's not that big of a line at Salumi anymore. Maybe now that the location has changed.
I mean, it's a bigger location. And they've also streamlined things with the online ordering, and there's grab-and-go sandwiches. I don't know if those were a thing beforehand, but you know they're really trying to get people in and out faster.
Interesting.
So you...
I did an online order, and it took an hour and 20 minutes.
Huh.
It was the longest I've ever waited for an online order. So I just assumed like that the line was incredible with that wait time.
Yeah, I don't know what was happening there, but it was not the line that was causing it. So I went with there ended up being a group of three of us. I went with a friend and a third person. One of his coworkers joined us late. And between us, we ended up ordering four sandwiches.
Okay.
Which allowed me to sample three different sandwiches there.
Okay.
So I did panic and screw up.
Did you order sushi?
Yeah, I ordered sushi. Shots to Zach. I wanted to get the oxtail, which is not always on, it's not on the permanent menu, but is a regular specialty item.
Okay.
And everything I read online suggested that the oxtail was tremendously good. And
really?
I should get that.
Okay, what is oxtail?
It's I don't know if I could actually explain it.
Okay.
Do you want me to look it up?
Yeah.
All right, you should fill a little bit here.
Well, I mean, could you explain the Seattle Light Rail in 1899? You didn't panic then. We went and found answers.
That is true. Okay, the culinary name for the tail of cattle.
Okay.
A gelatin-rich meat, which is usually still cooked as a stew or braised.
All right.
So anyway, instead of the oxtail, I went with the porchetta as a hot sandwich. And then I went with the mole salami sandwich. And then my friend wanted definitely to get the meatball sandwich, so I also had a half of that.
How was that meatball sandwich?
Do you want me to just get right into it, or do you want to talk about what you got?
I had the soppressata sandwich. Yeah.
You can just play that. I put the microphone up to that and play it.
And I subbed out, I think it normally comes with provolone, and I subbed it out for mozzarella.
Because provolone's way better.
You can get right out of here with that take. Fresh mozzarella is the best food in the entire world.
There's love a provolone on a sandwich.
It's at least the best cheese. Like, it doesn't work in all situations, but if I'm in a situation where I can eat fresh mozzarella on something, I'm going to do so. You know what I'm talking about? The one that's like soft and gooey from the ball? It's excellent.
Was that the type of mozzarella you got?
Yeah.
Okay, well, maybe I need to rethink this tick.
It's real mozzarella. It's not like sliced deli meat mozzarella. It's mozzarella.
Okay.
It's perfect, and it really brings the whole sandwich together. Okay, but I want to hear about everything. I'm especially, because I considered going with a second sandwich just to try the meatball.
Yeah, you should have. So I ordered three of them.
Oh, man.
If I'm going to rank those in inverse order, the cold sandwich, the mole salami, I mean, it was good, but it wasn't really special. I actually thought the best thing about it was, well, I guess I had the mozzarella there. So I thought that was the best thing about it. I mean, I knew that the salami is incredibly high quality. But one thing that I would say is that the baguette that they're serving it on, it's so thick that it kind of dominates the thinly sliced meat.
Too much baguette.
You agree?
Absolutely.
Okay. Then the porchetta would be in between. It was pretty good. Could have maybe used a little bit of sauce on there, I think. There's a certain degree of wetness to the meat itself. It still could have used a little bit more, I would say, to go along with it. Like maybe, or if it was like Chicago style, to be dipped and come, you know, fully like drenched that way, even though it already the bun got a little bit soggy, which was nice. But by far at the top of the list, not even close, was the meatball, which
damn
was
it.
Otherworldly. Like, first off, these meatballs are enormous. Like, I really think the only way to, like, actually eat it correctly is to, like, slice the meatballs in half and eat each of them, each side as an open-faced sandwich with that piece of bread. But
what type of bread are we talking here?
I mean, it was like... open, it was, you know...
Was it more like a French bread than a baguette?
I don't know if it was any different. They also say on a baguette, so...
Is it softer? Or has it just become softer because of the marinara?
It becomes softer because of the marinara.
Okay.
Yeah. And the meatballs were delicious. The marinara was outstanding. Like, I really wouldn't
think
of marinara.
Do they make the meatballs in-house?
Yeah. It's a family recipe.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, you
screwed up
here.
I could have family recipe meatballs.
Yeah.
It's fine. Like, I wanted to go with... the meatball sandwich is not, like, the classic sandwich or whatever.
And you could also do a la carte meatball. That is also a play.
I could have gotten a goddamn meatball on the side.
You sure could have. it's your own fault for not looking.
And what's the place in Portland, the pasta restaurant?
Grasa.
At Grasa, I would get pasta and then get meatballs on the side. Even if I'm having, like, a white sauce pasta, I'll just throw those red sauce meatballs in there because they're so good. This was a mistake. Mistakes have been made.
So I was going to say, you need to go back to try the meatball. But I don't know if you just want to wait until we go for whenever this is in the bracket of our search for Seattle's best sandwich. Because it's making it. I don't even care whatever you say.
Wow.
It's making it.
Okay. I feel like this is the most... Okay. So I had the soppressata sandwich, supposed to be like a spicier salami, had the mozzarella, they have kind of like a secret sauce on it. It's a good sandwich. right? You know that everything that you're eating is extremely high quality. But when I'm looking at it just like taste-wise, as far as eating it, it's like the baguette a little bit overwhelms everything else. The mozzarella is the best part because you can taste how fresh it is. The salami is very good. I could have used maybe a little bit more spice because there was no spice whatsoever on the spicy salami. I probably could have used like a little bit more flavor from it. But like to me, I would rather disassemble this and eat all of the individual parts on their own.
Interesting.
You know, I'd rather eat, or honestly, like I would rather eat just the salami and the mozzarella because that's the
way. By the way, you can also get a cured meat plate. That's also an option here, or a meat cheese olive plate.
But a cured meat plate would not have been a sandwich.
That is true. I mean, it doesn't qualify for a search. I'm just informing people of their options.
So it's extremely high quality meat and ingredients in general, but just thinking about it flavor wise, where I'm thinking, we're comparing this to the best sandwiches in Seattle, and it's just, it doesn't hit you with the flavor.
So you mean their meatball sandwich?
In the same sort of way. The meatball sandwich might though. Like, I guess what I need in my soul is that meatball sandwich.
I mean, I can tell that if I had only had the mole salami, I wouldn't be like, yeah, this is great, but I don't get the hype.
Yeah. I'd be like, it's fine.
Yeah. So it's a good thing that my friend was there to demand the meatball sandwich.
Meatball sandwiches, are they?
I mean, I think the porchetta and the oxtail, I would say, are the two most popular online. The meatball is...
mad about how good the meatball is.
The meatball is probably kind of polarizing. I think some people really love it, but not as many people as the porchetta.
Who wouldn't love a meatball sandwich?
I don't know. That's a great question. I mean, it's like challenging to eat. Required several napkins. There's a lot of marinara all over my face.
I did eat the sandwich while driving.
That's not ideal.
I would not have been able to do that with the meatball sub.
I also like kind of hurt my jaw a little bit trying to eat it.
Because of the meatball sandwich?
It is, yeah. I don't know, I think so.
Long-term jaw injuries. So when I was in college, and we'll do a podcast specifically about this later on. When I was in college, we used to play. We would go to Subway on the Ave because they'd have sandwiches for whatever, $5 at certain times. Or like certain sandwiches were $5 footlongs at the time. And I would get two sandwiches.
This was the style of the time.
I would get a turkey sandwich and a meatball sub and subsequently eat them both.
Nice.
And so I'd play a fun game with Katie at the time, which she loved, which was how many feet of sandwich are in me right now? A lot of the times it was 2 feet of sandwich.
Wow.
But the meatball's always a winner, even at Subway. What I'm trying to say is, even at Subway, the meatball sandwich is great. The only time that a meatball sandwich doesn't work is if it's like baked and it's overcooked, like if you overtoast it.
To me, the issue oftentimes with meatball sandwich is that the ratio of like meatball to bread ratio can be too low because you don't have complete coverage. Like you'll have bites that are just bread and there's no meatball.
Uh-huh.
You're in no danger of that here.
Wow. It's a lot of meatball.
It's a lot of meatball.
God, I might have to go back tomorrow.
Do you have a rating for Salumi? It doesn't matter what you rate it. Moving on.
That's fine with me. It's a tough thing to rate. I don't know. It's like a 92.
I rated it a 95.
Wow. Is this your third highest score? Wow. There's grade fixing going on with these sandwich ratings. A 95 is your third highest score?
I mean, every time I go into it saying, oh, this is going to be the time I'm going to have a better spread of grades. I'm going to really utilize the curve. And then I get into it and I love it so much.
They're all in like 85 to 95.
Okay, they're not quite all there.
If
Also, I mean, two of the sandwiches are higher than 95. That's the point.
What are the two that are higher than 95 so far?
The other Coast and Tats. Oh, no.
Maono?
No, this came in ahead of Tats. If I'm going to one place in Pioneer Square, I'm going to Salumi for that meatball sandwich.
They're just such different things, you know? But
that's what we're here for. It's to evaluate different things.
Because the people out there can only eat one sandwich.
But what if you're a traveler?
God, that Maono chicken sandwich is so good.
It's a really good sandwich.
Okay.
We've got some good eating ahead of us when we get into the tournament.
I was excited about getting to Salumi, though. And I didn't revel in it in the same way. Like this was one of sandwiches.
I can't guarantee that you're gonna revel in the meatball, but I like your odds.
Oh, man, I've really let myself down.
You let the listener down.
I hold myself to very high sandwich standard. So if you didn't have the meatball, what would the grade have been?
90.
Okay. So
5 points at least.
It's a good sandwich. It's just not Seattle's best sandwich.
Yes.
However, the meatball sandwich
might be Seattle's best sandwich.
Is in the conversation.
It is.
Wow. That's a big difference. And also, as everyone should know, a restaurant is only as good as its best item.
You're preaching to the preacher who previously preached that to you.
We go back and forth preaching it to each other. We never get sick of it.
I invented that. I want credit for it.
Because the thing is, when you go to a restaurant, you don't need to order 4 sandwiches like you did.
Yeah.
You can order just one 4 times if you'd like.
It's true. They probably won't refuse you.
So
I also do not recommend eating 4 salumi sandwiches. 1.5. Again, my only meal for the day.
I was feeling pretty full after lunch. It's a giant sandwich.
Yeah, and the meatball is more filling, I would say, than the other one.
Oh my god! All right, I may go back this week. I might save it for the bracket. I might go back this week. We'll see what happens.
It's always 50-50.
But I'm pretty excited in this moment about that meatball sandwich.
Yeah, me too.
God damn it. All right.
Should we get to Seattle sports? Well, the Sounders, you will be sad to learn, their U.S. Open Cup bid has come to a rapid conclusion after just 90 minutes of action. Earlier Wednesday night, as they lost 2-1 to Portland at Cheney Stadium in Tacoma, I would say for the most part, the Sounders did actually try their hardest in this one.
They're just bad.
Well, they're just missing a lot of players due to international duty. And Portland, for whatever quirk of, you know, how the roster was constructed, their 3 designated players, none of them were called up to their national team.
And they all played?
They all played.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
So Portland also took this game very seriously. The Sounders basically started generally the best players they had available. You know, the Will Bruins, the Victor Rodriguez's, but, you know, it obviously was a very limited lineup. Danny Leyva, the 17-year-old, got his first start for, or is he 16? 16 or 17? I think 16.
It's just depressing to me, age.
Yes. Got his first start for the Sounders after coming on as a reserve against Toronto in their last MLS match before the international break. They did start their backup keeper, Brian Meredith, is I anticipated. The Sounders gave up a goal to Brian Fernandez in the opening minutes of this game, equalized just before halftime with a Victor Rodriguez free kick that was deflected off the wall into the goal, but Fernandez scored again shortly into the second half, and the Sounders could not come up with a second goal. Despite getting a penalty, Rodriguez missed a penalty in the 79th minute. That ended up costing them.
He missed a penalty?
Yeah.
Wow. And this would have gone to extra time had he hit it. Or, well, if he hit it, nobody else scored after that.
Yes.
Wow.
If both of those conditions were satisfied.
Were you watching?
No.
So you don't know how he missed it?
I just saw off the crossbar is what the Twitter account said.
Wow. Okay. I mean, I guess, whatever. Like, the Sounders were without a lot of players. I'm happy that they took it seriously. For the sake of our argument last week, there's
I
mean, also
I was a little,
something
I was a concerned when, as I tweeted out from the PeltonCast account, they announced that they had signed 6 Tacoma Defiance players to short-term contracts.
And that was just basically to like fill out the roster.
Yeah. One of those players did come in is a reserve, at, I think, left back for Nuhu, but that was it. They were mostly just there.
I think the real question here is, the form that the Sounders are in right now, even being without kind of some of their star players, it does feel like this is a unique season for the Sounders.
Because they're not terrible right now?
No, not because they're not terrible, but
because they're not being
they started
off
out
for the playoffs?
Very good and then have kind of gotten
yes.
Terrible?
I mean, not terrible. They've gotten poor. Bad. They've also been on the road a tremendous amount in this stretch, which is one reason why they've struggled.
So what do we anticipate right now that we're getting like a little bit deeper into the very long MLS season?
Oh, it's such a long MLS season. I think the Sounders are going to be fine. I mean, you know, most players should be back from international break by the time they come back from, by the time they next play an MLS game or any game now, being out of the U.S. Open Cup on June 29th, I believe. So, you know, I think Nicola Ladero still might be in action in Copa America at that point, which is starting later than the CONCACAF Gold Cup. And the European, it's just qualifying, so that's already over. So Gustav Svensson will be back. I don't know who else is.
Gustav Svensson's on the Swedish team?
He is, yeah.
All right, good for him.
Yeah, they knocked out the Italian team from the World Cup, you'll recall.
I remember that.
So I think I'm not too concerned about it. I think the Sounders, you know, probably could still stand to add a little depth at the mid-season transfer window.
Yeah, so are they going to have the kind of will they have a spot open to add a designated player?
No, because of the fact that the they added a designated player in the earlier transfer window.
So who are the designated players right now? There are four?
No, there's three.
Okay, so Rui Diaz.
Ladero.
And Jordan Morris?
No, it's the new defender who made his debut right before the international break, whose name currently escapes me off the top. Javier Arriaga. He came in as a designated player who they may eventually be able to buy down.
Okay.
Out of the designated player spot using targeted allocation money.
Would they be able to do that this summer?
Possibly. But there's also longstanding rumors that the MLS is going to get rid of the third designated player spot, so you don't necessarily want to bring in someone in that this summer.
They're going to get rid of the third designated player spot?
Yes, and just have two of them.
Why?
Too much of a difference between the haves and the have-nots financially.
I don't think I understand that decision from a, like...
It does seem like a strange time for that with the league growing as much as it is.
But I thought you were going to say, when you started saying that sentence, I thought you were going to say it's looking like the league is going to get rid of having designated players and not designated players and just have a free-for-all.
They're definitely not doing that. The shadow of the NASL's spending looms over MLS even now, even what... more than two decades into the league's existence.
When by all accounts, the league is very strong at this point.
Yeah, but not everyone is equally strong. Some are stronger than others.
This is fucking soccer, though. This is not the type of sport where you necessarily need parity, right?
No, but it's also an American sport, and the people who agree on the rules, they're the owners of the teams. So... you know, the smaller market teams are not necessarily going to agree to things.
Who are the small market teams now, though? Like, what does it mean?
You know, like Columbus, for example, is relatively, like, they're bringing in smaller markets than or in most, you know, other competing American leagues.
I thought you were going to say, not by European standards, because there's major standards. Teams and cities that have like 3,000 people in them.
Leicester City went in the EPL. But like, you know, Austin, where they're going to. These are not like...
Austin's going to have a team?
Yeah.
Wow.
Columbus was going to move to Austin, but now they're going to put an expansion franchise in Austin.
And Columbus is staying?
Yes.
But like Cincinnati, are they considered a small market team or are they spending money?
I don't know how much payroll they're necessarily spending, but that's definitely a small market team.
Okay.
And I don't think it necessarily correlates exactly with the size of the city because, you know, if you're someone like Portland, the support is so enormous there that it's better than being a relatively minor player in a bigger city. But clearly, if you look at the teams that are spending the most on designated players, it's the New York teams historically, the LA teams now, and the Sounders probably fall in that group as well.
MLS has not... the teams aren't so reliant on local TV deals like a baseball team is, right?
They're not getting much of anything from local TV, I don't think, no.
So like that's the big divider in a sport like baseball that doesn't have a salary cap, right? Is these local TV deals where some teams are getting massive deals and others are basically getting nothing. So like what is the difference, all things considered, in the market?
I mean, I think there is still some level of ticket sales, but probably sponsorships would be the biggest aspect of it, I think. You know, if you're a team like the Galaxy or LAFC, you're probably bringing in a lot more in sponsorship revenue. and maybe premium seat revenue. I mean, that's the familiar things from the NBA where, you know, the attendance isn't necessarily a big factor. The local TV deal can be, but a lot of times it's the premium seat revenue and it's the sponsorship that divide teams.
But in the NBA, like, the teams that dominate aren't the major market teams. I guess that's because of the salary cap.
That is.
But, yeah, okay.
I don't know. You proved the point.
No, I
don't know which is best for the future of the MLS, but I know which MLS owners think is better for the future of the MLS, and it's the one where
it
they
is
don't
interesting
have to spend
though.
As much
so,
money.
So MLS has gone through this period of being open to adding in sort of like smaller market teams to fill out the league, right?
Yes.
So recently, it's like you have Cincinnati, whatever, like. Apparently Austin coming, Minnesota, Atlanta. Not that these are necessarily smaller markets, but like willingness to expand very quickly.
Yes.
But that also means that there's a lot more seats at the table as far as owners go.
Yes.
And so that would be like the idea of why they'd be open to the idea of limiting the amount of designated players from where it's at now, because all of a sudden you have voices at the table that are a little bit more have-nots.
I think the other argument in defense of this is that it's not necessary, you know, maybe to have the third designated player spot because of the fact that you can do a lot of things with the targeted allocation money.
Don't you think there's something to be said for the way that every other league in the entire world functions, though?
Well, every other league in the entire world has promotion and relegation. Do you think that's coming to MLS anytime soon? Because
I don't get why not. If we can do it in our fantasy league, why can't they do it in MLS?
Well, we sort of did it. But because of the fact that the owners are, again, the ones who are deciding on it, and they're the owners that currently have teams in this league. I mean, I feel like it's much more likely that international soccer will more closely match the American model of professional sports than the other way around.
Really?
Yeah.
You think that there would be a time where the EPL or whatever doesn't have relegation?
The top clubs wield so much power that I don't know that they would want to risk it. I mean, that seems more likely to happen in the Champions League at this point, a permanent Champions League where the teams don't change from year to year.
Permanent Champions League.
Yeah, I think that's I've read some talk about that.
That would be kind of fun.
It would be fun if your team is in there.
But there's something to be said for the fighting for these like fourth spots or whatever.
It's true. But you know who doesn't have something to say for it? The owners of the teams who are likely to lose out on it because of that. So
I'm surprised that I would have guessed from what you were saying and from where I perceive the MLS to be just MLS. Be
indefinite object.
I would have assumed that they would be adding more designated players, not less.
And that plan still may not come to fruition. I haven't read anything about it recently, but that's, again, the expectation. So speaking of those players who were off on international duty, that included Christian Roldan, who started both USMNT exhibition losses to Jamaica and Venezuela in the past week.
They lost to Jamaica?
Sure did. 1-0 and 3-0 to Venezuela.
Maybe they should just fold the league instead of limiting the amount of players.
You can't blame the U.S. men's national team strictly on MLS. That's not fair. Jordan Morris came off the bench versus Venezuela. The USMNT will open Gold Cup play next Tuesday against Guyana. So
2-0 loss.
Things will be very, very bad. They'll probably have a new coach. They'll fire Greg Berhalter, who I just learned on Sunday while watching that exhibition match against Venezuela.
Is the coach.
Is the coach of the
U.S. Who is in the Gold Cup? Where? What territories does this extend to?
It's North America and the Caribbean. It's CONCACAF.
So who's the favorite in the Gold Cup? Mexico?
I mean, the U.S. and Mexico basically traded off.
Okay.
So at this point, I would have to say Mexico is the favorite. The U.S. had actually played well like at the start of the year, but yeah, the last two matches have been disastrous, ruinous. Reign FC returns from a one-week break by hosting league-leading Washington Spirit on Saturday night. The U.S. women's national team finally got its Women's World Cup underway on Tuesday and beat an overmatched Thailand squad 13-0 in that match. Megan Rapinoe scored the 9th goal for the U.S. women's national team, which is just not
She scored 9 goals.
No, just the 9th goal. which is not a phrase you often utter, and assisted on two others in the match play in the full 90 for the USWNT.
Is Thailand the worst team in the Women's World Cup?
I believe they are the lowest rated, yes.
Okay.
It would be troubling if they were a weaker team.
I'm really fascinated to see how other teams play Thailand.
Yes. I mean, I don't know that they'll score 13 goals. I believe, Sweden must have them next because the U.S. and Sweden, who are the top two teams in that group, play in the final match of group play.
Who is the fourth team in the group?
Chile.
Chile?
Yeah.
All right. Did Sweden beat Chile?
They did. I believe 2-0. The Seattle Storm split two games to start their four-game road trip, losing 78-71 on Sunday at Chicago, dropping to 0-2 against the Sky on the road this season, but getting an 84-82 win on Tuesday at Indiana. Joel Lloyd, the hero late there, making three free throws in the late stages to take the Storm from down one to the final two-point victory, as the Fever were unable to score on the final possession of the game. The Storm, now at 4-3 on the season, we'll head on Friday to Washington in a rematch of last year's WNBA Finals on CBS Sports. And on Sunday, they take on the Connecticut Sun, one of the favorites and hottest starting teams so far this year, at 12:30 p.m. on ABC in a nationally televised matinee.
All right.
So Natasha Howard has continued to be really dominant for the Storm. She was the WNBA, the Western Conference Player of the Week.
Really?
For the previous week, including the Storm's previous road trip, and then them coming home for the one game they played at home and beating Minnesota at that point unbeaten. The Lynx have kind of fallen off a little bit since then. So, you know, it's taken a bit of shine off the Storm's performance. But, you know, Natasha Howard right now, third in the league in scoring, taking over for Breanna Stewart as the go-to player in the front court. It's been kind of awesome to watch. She's also second in the league in steals per game, where first in the league is Jordan Canada.
Wow.
Storm get a lot of steals right now.
Of that 4-3 record, how many of those seven games have been at home?
Two of the seven have been at home.
So this is pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, the schedule has actually been kind of soft when you account for the fact that they've played some of the weaker teams in the league. Like the first road win they got, the most impressive road win they have this season, was at Atlanta, and it now turns out that Atlanta is just really bad this season, much worse than anyone anticipated for a team that I think had the second seed behind the Storm in last year's WNBA playoffs before losing to Washington in that semifinal, getting upset.
But how many games do you play at home and on the road?
17 apiece.
So being 2-0 at home and 2-3 on the road already.
Yes.
What would you put their percentage chances of making the playoffs at right now?
So I've got a simulation, of course. Who doesn't have their WNBA playoff simulation?
It's like you prepped me on this question.
It is. I didn't at all. The latest.
I thought it would be similar to when I asked you earlier. What was the question?
About the interurban or about Oxtail?
About Oxtail. You'd be like, so an Oxtail is.
I just know it's good, okay? I know people like it. I don't know what it is. I've eaten it before. I don't know what it is. The Storm project for an average of 19 wins out of 34 and 93% chance of making the playoffs based on this simulation.
There we go.
Yeah. So not bad.
Yeah.
For a team that's playing without Breanna Stewart and Sue Bird. All right, let's move on to University of Washington sports. And first, an important Seattle Times story on Wednesday by Asia Fields on Senior Associate Athletic Director Roy Schick quietly leaving the UW Athletic Department last year after allegations of sexual assault against former Husky volleyball star Cassie Strickland, who is serving as an intern in the Tyee Department for Athletic Given, which is overseen by Schick at the time. After her allegations were made to the athletic department and were found credible, Schick resigned and went into the business sector before being hired as the vice president of Grand Canyon University, which fired him after learning of the Seattle Times report. So, you know, kind of disturbing to realize that there was no way, it didn't appear that there was any way that Grand Canyon University could have known about the misconduct by Schick at UW, and that, you know,
just shocked that he was able to pivot to the business sector at all.
I mean, and it's
that
tough.
That this didn't become public in any way.
It's tough because clearly, initially, Strickland did not want it to become public, did not want to report it to police, and that's part of why it kind of got buried within the university to some extent. But, yeah, I mean...
Do you feel like...
if it hadn't been for the Seattle Times serving this watchdog function, it's possible no one would have known for many years. Or if ever.
What were they doing in this watchdog function?
I
like, how did they know?
May have been some sort of freedom of information request, or I don't know if there was a... I don't know how the story began exactly.
Okay, so you can delete this if you want. But what do you think the responsibility is of the university to make this public?
I don't think they have a responsibility to make it public, especially because, again, she didn't at that point want to make it public. She did... comment to the Seattle Times on this and was okay with, you know, it being made public in that way. I mean, it's tough, but it does seem like there needs to be some sort of mechanism by which, you know, this can be disclosed to potential future employers.
Yeah, that, I mean, that to me is like, I feel like there's some responsibility here. Like, I suppose if the perspective is that Cassie Strickland didn't want it to be public at all, and didn't want any sort of that conversation to happen, then that's one thing. Because if it was disclosed to future employers, the chances of it leaking publicly are probably pretty high.
I don't know about that.
But at the same time, this is like...
It feels to me more like a system breakdown.
Yeah.
And I think the big thing that the article kind of tried to pin on the athletic department was the fact that she signed a settlement in exchange for receiving funding for counseling. And... I think that might have potentially been a little unfair because of the fact that I don't know that when she came forward initially, she was seeking a settlement, that this was something that the university pressured, the athletic department pressured her into, as opposed to just offering it to her kind of voluntarily, if that makes sense. But
I mean, this to me feels like the university wanted this to go away and never think about it again.
Possibly, but again, at that point, so did the victim. So yeah. It's tough to not honor those wishes as well. And that's where, you know, sometimes this is a challenge. So in happier news, John Rothstein of CBS Sports was the first to report that Garfield High grad Jerron Brooks will transfer to UW from USC. He would have 3 years of eligibility under Pac-12 after a Pac-12 rule change that's just recently taken place, where they will no longer take away a year of eligibility.
This is the kind of rule change I can get behind.
Players who transfer in conference. Brooks was a consensus top 100 prospect who chose USC over UW shortly after Mike Hopkins' arrival in Seattle. Briefly actually changed his commitment to St. John's before ending up at USC. Didn't play much as a freshman. Averaged 2.0 points and 1.3 rebounds in 8.2 minutes per game. And he will fill the scholarship created by Jalen Noel's departure for the NBA.
Wow. There's a lot of news that I was unaware of in here.
Yeah, I mean, this is...
just glancing ahead. My
this is
God.
Good news. Like, Brooks was not very good as a freshman, so there's some concern there. But, you know, everyone
Whatever.
Saw him at the high school level
this
was
is,
convinced that he was a
As opposed to a walk-on or somebody that they'd be signing this late.
True, yeah.
You don't have to think about this in terms of will Jerron Brooks be contributing to the team next year? Probably not.
Well, no, I mean, he'll still have to sit out a season in all likelihood unless he gets a waiver.
Okay, will Jerron Brooks...
You just don't lose... It, but previously,
you
if he had transferred, he would have then come in as a junior. He would have lost that year as opposed to being able to take it as a redshirt.
Moves like this make me feel better long-term about the Husky program. What I want is for...
Huskies to be able to keep players at home? Build a fence?
No. I mean, yes.
You don't want that?
I do want that. But
you should want that.
Specifically, what I want is I want more than just Jaden McDaniels and Isaiah Stewart.
You want depth?
Yeah, I want depth and I want long-term depth.
Yeah.
I don't want it to be one season where they're taking the shot with players who most likely those two will be one-and-done players.
Yes.
I want it to be that the year after that there's something. And because being in this situation of getting one-and-done type players for a school like UW, which doesn't have the pedigree of someplace like Duke, Kentucky, whatever, I mean, they're not going to be able to do it consistently. They have to build a program. They have to sort of look at somebody like Gonzaga and build a little bit more in that way.
I mean, but I think it's also important to get someone like Jaden McDaniels because of the fact that it's a signal to, you know, the other top prospects in the Seattle area that, like, this is the place to go.
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason that Jaron Brooks transferred to UW versus somewhere else is because of these players.
I mean, I don't know about that specifically. I wouldn't attribute that thought to him. But I think it is, you know, definitely a good indicator going forward to be able to successfully recruit the best Seattle prospects.
Yeah.
Brooks, we know, will be playing against Gonzaga because UW and Gonzaga announced a 4-year extension of their non-conference series through the 2023-24 season. That series resumed in 2016 after a 9-year hiatus due to the strained relationship between the coaching staffs on the two sides. UW has lost all 3 meetings since the resumption.
Gotta beat Gonzaga.
5 in a row. Oh. And 12 of the last 13 overall. The God only exception apparently Gonzaga. Made the Brandon Roy game against Adam Morrison when those two guys were going head-to-head in their final college
this
seasons.
This is the new UW football versus Oregon.
Kind of is, yeah.
This is the hump that you need.
I mean, it's
to
not as
over.
Important because it's not a conference game, but yes.
Well, no individual college basketball game is as important as any individual college football game, but this
true.
Is like, right, this is not even Oregon. This is not another state. This is in your state. Another team is out there getting one seeds, playing in NCAA championship
games.
Yeah,
I don't think Nebraska's going to necessarily stop that.
I'm just saying, like, look, it ended for Oregon, too.
It did. Mark Few hasn't left to go coach the Philadelphia 76ers just yet.
I'm just waiting for the right job to open up for Mark Few to go to. I don't know what it would be yet. Pretty much every job in the country has been open, except for Duke.
Did you see that it could be an NBA. Did you see the Cleveland Cavaliers hired Cal women's basketball head coach Lindsey Gottlieb as an assistant?
Absolutely, I did.
Yeah?
Yeah. I don't think that's happening with Mark Few.
No, he would. I mean, Mark Few, he's not leaving Gonzaga. It would be stunning if he left Gonzaga.
We just have to beat Gonzaga one time.
I agree.
God.
Maybe this is the year. We'll see. Finally, on the men's basketball front, the NCAA Plain Rules Oversight Panel approved moving the three-point line back from its current distance of 20 feet 9 inches to the FIBA distance of 22 feet 1 and 3-quarter inches. The line moved back to its current distance from 19 feet 9 inches in 2008-09. Three-point attempts dropped that year from 34.4% of shot attempts to 33% and needed 8 seasons to get back to previous levels, as well as 9 seasons for three-point percentage to get back to previous levels.
So what is the NBA length?
It's only 22 feet in the corner, but up to 23 foot 9 at the top of the arc.
They're getting a lot closer.
Yes. They're about half, give or take. Maybe, I guess, more like 40%.
What is the purpose of not just doing it at the NBA length?
That's a really long shot. And NCAA players are not as skilled as NBA players. Fun fact.
Who does that benefit?
Guys who are good at shooting the shorter distance. And like the mediocre shooters are most affected by this, I would say. Like, if you're a
but
really
like
good shooter, it doesn't matter.
Program-wise, on, like, a bigger level, do you think that a longer three-point line benefits sort of, like, the better recruiting teams?
I would say probably not in as much as recruiting is not... Recruiting, like, ranking is usually not that highly correlated with shooting ability. You know, eventually, if you get guys who can score at that who can be a threat at that distance, the better spacing does help more.
That's what I was
players.
Thinking about, spacing, where it's just like...
But you have to get the players who are capable of making that shot first, and that's going to take some time. I mean, this is a bigger change than in 2008-09, when it was only a foot.
And this is going to happen next year?
It's going to happen next year.
Wow, I'm fascinated to see how that goes.
It'll be also interesting. I retweeted a story from Syracuse.com about how this could affect the orange 2-3 zone with Ken Pomeroy, former Third Pelton brother Ken Pomeroy, offering his thoughts. It'll be particularly interesting for the Huskies.
Something negative about the Pac-12 to say?
Did not come. I mean, it'll be particularly interesting for the Huskies the way they've prioritized perimeter defense and taking away three-point attempts. Will now you be stretching the zone so much that there will be huge open spaces in the mid-range for teams to take advantage of? Or will you not have to guard the three-point line quite as tightly because now it's a greater distance and fewer players are actually capable of making that shot?
A lot less players are going to be three-point shooters.
It's going to be fascinating to see how this evolves.
Huh. So that, like, time period that it takes to reach those same levels, is that just like teams adjusting to the new three-point line, or is that just like the progress of basketball that people are always going to be shooting more and more and more threes?
Probably the progress of basketball. I mean, the interesting thing is that, you know, it just moves it farther out of touch with the high school line, which is still at 19 foot 9 inches, which seems like a layup compared to the longer FIBA and NBA distances. So it may take longer for freshmen to adjust now because of that. I wouldn't be surprised if that were the case.
Hmm, cool. Good for the Huskies team coming up next year.
I mean, I don't know that Isaiah Stewart's shooting a lot of threes, my man.
No, I think if they have anybody who can space the floor, it'll probably be better.
I feel like Quade Green's going to be okay with the longer three-point line.
The spacing is going to be the most
Nas
important.
Carter, I do not feel like that's... Oh, I feel like, man, that's a tough adjustment.
Nas Carter is not a long three-point shooter.
Not really. Not his thing. All right, let's wrap things up with the Seahawks, who are holding their mini camp this week. Coach Pete Carroll had no update on Michael Kendrick's legal situation as he awaits sentencing on his guilty plea to insider trading, but told reporters that we do expect him to be on the team this year. And I would say the other bit of news to come out so far is also at the linebacker position, where rookie fifth-round pick Ben Burkervin is sidelined for this minicamp after undergoing surgery for a sports hernia.
Okay, but we'll be back by training camp.
Should be, I think.
And all accounts seem to be that Cody Barton is playing quite well.
Yeah.
Seemed like DK Metcalf looked good. I don't know.
Russell Wilson was ravey about DK Metcalf.
God, I'm so excited.
The DK Metcalf hype meter, it's like over 100% already. It can't get any higher, and yet it keeps getting higher.
I'm excited for DK Metcalf. And we're getting closer to football, too. Do you know how I can tell?
Because it's so hot?
It's insanely hot. Training camp has to be
coming
soon.
Which is weird
soon.
Because most of the season it is very cold and rainy.
But when it's training camp, it's hot.
It is. That is accurate.
If you add some smoke to the mix, all of a sudden training camp would be here really soon.
I don't think that's how it works, actually. I think it'll take the same amount of time either way.
But man, I mean, basketball has like 1 week left at most, right?
Less than that. It's got, depending when you're listening to this, 4 days left at most.
4 days left at most.
Yeah.
And then football's coming.
Yeah, first there's all of NBA free agency and the NBA draft.
Plus hydroplane racing.
Oh. Well, hydroplane racing is kind of at the start of CX training camp, so.
Okay. Hydroplane racing, the USWNT sandwiches.
WNBA All-Star Game.
Mina Kimes' live podcast.
Maybe some announcements about other live podcasts. There's plenty to look forward to.
There's a lot coming. But football is coming.
Football is coming. Winter is coming. On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
Considered possibly not watching John Wick 2 because I was not that interested in John Wick 1.
And it just took a quantum leap forward between one and two.
It's not even close.
Wow. Weirdly, the first one doesn't star Keanu Reeves.
Good stuff. You know, Boban's in the third one.
I'm well aware. I've seen the Boban scene, at least what they were able to show of it on The Jump.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I have not been to an adult movie in a movie theater since... I have no idea.
That was a long pause.
I really cannot come up with what it was. It has been years, but I'm seriously thinking about going to see John Wick 3.
How much longer is it going to be in theaters?
I was thinking of going on Friday.
Because it's been about a month, right? Or not, yeah, just about a month, 4 weeks.
There must have been a movie that I went to go see. But if I didn't, I don't know.
I'm trying to think what the last movie is I remember going to.
I went to the first Star Wars remake movie. Which is probably
the current
winter
trilogy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not that long ago.
Episode 10.
That would be winter 16, right? Or 15 going into 16, at the end of 16.
That's kind of a long time ago.
That is. But I was thinking it was going to be longer even than that.
Not episode 10, episode 7.
That is in fact episode 7, yes.
Oh, God. It's so hot.
It's quite hot. That is accurate.
My house, like, it just holds heat in. I'm like, don't open up the fucking windows during the day. Because if it gets hot in here, it will never get unhot.
Oh, yeah. It's not going to get hot if you don't open the windows. No heat will come in otherwise.
It stays pretty cool pretty late. Oh, God. Let me see what the temperature is. Like, outside, it's pretty nice. We should potentially consider recording outside.
What kind of background noise do you think there's going to be?
I don't think it would be that bad. I think it would be pretty... I would talk quieter, though. That's the thing.
Yes.
And I need to get off my, like, high-level John Ralphio takes.
Oh, yeah.
Because I have a lot of takes about whatever we're talking about this week.
The U.S. Open Cup. You clearly do have takes about the U.S. Open Cup, so I guess that will be the case.
It's still 85 degrees in the house.
Well, that is exceedingly hot.
Like, how is that possible? This house holds heat so well, in a bad way. I got to get that fan going.
Yeah, you do got to get that fan going.
Oh, God. Are you ready to record this?
Yeah, let's do it.
Wait, hold on. Let me pull the notes. I don't even know anything about any of the sports stuff we're talking about, if there is any.
There's a surprising amount of Husky men's basketball news.
Really?
Yeah.
That I'm completely unaware of all of it.
Apparently. It'll be new to you.